So here's the thing. This thing called Te Internet is moving off the web, and it's moving on to us, and it's moving on to the things around us. And our next speaker, Matt Jones, is going to tell us all about that. Matt's worked at the BBC, he's worked at Nokia, he's currently at Doppler, and he wins the title for the best, wins the prize for the best presentation title of the conference, The Demon Haunted World. Please welcome Matt Jones.
Hello.
My name's Matt Jones. I've just been given a very nice introduction. I've been working on a startup for 2 years, which is why I look like this, and called Doppler. And I'm also an advisor to a small product company called Schultz & Webb, who made that tiny version of me that jumps up and down depending on my IM status. I worked previously at Nokia, initially in design research, doing a lot of stuff into looking into RFID back in 2003. And in the previous millennium, I trained to be an architect. And all of those things are kind of work through this, because Tash and Mike graciously said I didn't have to talk about my day job, I didn't have to talk about Doppler. And so as a result, I have to give you a warning, or three. I may have lost my mind. I think this is the weirdest thing I've ever spoken about in public. I'm going to go pretty fast because I've got 92 slides to get through. They had to take the computer away from me in the end. And finally, this presentation contains use of the blink tag. So if you're offended by such things, I'll give you a warning when that comes in. I'm going to talk about cities and the subtitle of The Demon Haunted World, incredibly pretentious title, is equally pretentious, which is Practical City Magic. City magic is a phrase I use a lot, a whole bunch of things tagged in delicious with this gnomic phrase, city magic. It comes from a comic book I love called The Invisibles by Grant Morrison, who was mentioned earlier by Anna Lee, a comic book called We Three, which will make you cry about a robotic rabbit if you read it. The reason I want to talk about this is kind of informed by two kind of overwhelming mega trends in the world that we looked a lot into when I was at Nokia. First one is the rising urbanization of the planet. We're becoming a city-based species. And the other side of this, the other sort of mega trend, is the kind of rapid digitalization, if that's even a word, of those cities. And as Mike said, the kind of inverting of the internet into the real world, as William Gibson has talked about or written about. And this graph, it's not really a graph, is it? Is kind of probably the inside of my brain. And you can pretty much reconstruct everything I do from this one graph, I think, probably. Let's expect some facts. Facts will make this better. It's expected that 60% of the world population will be urban by 2030, and most of the urban growth will occur in less developed countries. We've also gone through the most vigorous period of city building we've ever done as a species. That's kind of come to an end now with the kind of the end of capitalism and all of that good stuff. But it's left us a lot of toys in the urban box to play with. So in the next 40 minutes or so, less than that now, 41 minutes, 47 seconds, I'm going to talk about three things broadly. Firstly, I'm going to look at some kind of optimistic visions of the future from the past that we might have lost sight of. Kind of, you know, those t-shirts people wear saying, you know, this was meant to be the future, where's my jetpack? Here's your jetpack. Here it is. More coming. Secondly, I'm going to sort of walk through some ways that hackers and designers are kind of making what I sort of see as reconfigured versions of these futures. And lastly, and probably most weirdly, I'm going to make some kind of wild proclamations about the future we're weaving. And that's the kind of weird, dark icing at the center of this sandwich. The sort of dark matter of all of this is software, which we're all somehow involved in. So if you're sitting comfortably, I'll begin. So as I say, to figure some of this stuff out, I think we have to go back to the future. And we have to go a lot further back than 1984. But we have to go back into the kind of Cold War. And I've been reading a lot about kind of post-war period and Cold War period lately, which has kind of influenced this turn of thought. Also, I'm a child of the 70s. I was born in 1972. And I grew up with loads of books with images like this in it, which I thought were, you know, perfectly reasonable things that were going to happen by the time I was 37. This is a picture of Bernal Sphere, kind of experimental design for a space colony, which was dreamed up by a group from NASA and Stanford University in 1975-1976. Looks like this from the outside. And I think it was 1976 or so, I remember being sold a little plastic hat, a little plastic safety hat to protect me from Skylab falling on me. So I grew up with lots of books like this, and I'm incredibly grateful to my friend Tom Coates for sharing scans of his copy of this book. And I think perhaps the fact we both had this book growing up is going to become perfectly apparent when you see our talk side by side. And the image, looking through this, is just fantastic. Is this center spread about two trips to the 21st century. And at the top there, you've got a polluted city of a dying world. And at the bottom, with the monorail and the nuclear-powered pink truck and the garden, the hedgerows, you have a garden city on a cared-for planet. That little kind of concrete donut just by the side of the garden city is a giant nuclear fusion reactor in a tokamak, which is going to power that. Excellent. And I, as I say, moving on from the 70s, I sort of grew up and trained to be an architect. And the web came along in 1994, and I kind of got distracted for a while. But a lot of the work I've been doing in the last few years has drawn me back into the kind of world of architecture and of cities and of place and of urban design, especially where it overlaps with technology. And this is Richard Rogers. He's one of the best-known architects in the world, I guess. He's a prominent member of the British establishment. He's even a Lord, Lord Rogers. He wrote two books a few years ago, one called Cities for a Small Planet, and a companion book later called Cities for a Small Country. And both of them centered around his practice in urban design and his belief that cities are the most promising technical, political, and cultural form and solution to living on a planet with constrained resources. And late last year, I went to a talk by Lord Rogers, or Dickie, as I like to call him, as he likes me to call him, like that. And he said something quite evocative. He said that our cities are increasingly linked and learning, and that, this talk started to gestate. And as a soundbite, it was kind of more effective as a time machine than Doc Brown's DeLorean. It just like swung me right back into this period I've been reading about. Because back in the 60s, when he wasn't a lord and he was inhaling and all of that good stuff, Richard Rogers was a pretty radical architect, and he was reconfiguring old cities like Paris with brand new crazy things like the Pompidou Center, which he did with Renzo Piano, based on radical theories of the time of cybernetics and social networks and space and robotics and orbital colonies and all of that kind of stuff. And those were radical theories that came out of a group called Archigram. Who's heard of Archigram? Just to let your good people. Archigram were a group of young architects who decided to make magazines rather than buildings. They made magazines out of their ideas, their drawings, their manifestos from 1961 to about 1974. Even if you don't know Archigram, perhaps you've seen this image of one of their projects by one of the group called Ron Heron, of a walking city that kind of picked itself up and went around the planet looking for resources. And their influence was far, far greater than the number of buildings they actually got built. I think they didn't really get any buildings built until about 1997, when Peter Cook did an art center in Linz in Austria. But their influence is enormous, and the picture of the golf course on the aircraft carrier isn't an Archigram image, but I just love it. I found it on a site called Building Blog, which I recommend you read every day because it's wonderful. But Archigram weren't really just architects. They were really interaction designers. They were software designers. They wanted to create architecture without architecture. They wanted to look at how you could use behavior as a raw material. And this was a time when cybernetics and software were seen to be able to decide big things, like how to run a country or how to how to start or stop a nuclear war. It was also a time when technology needed a room because it was big, and that meant it could be architecturally groovy. This is CyberSyn, which was designed by a British cyberneticist called Stafford Beer and a bunch of other people, Fernando Flores and others, at the request of Salvador Allende, president of Chile, before he was deposed, to run Chile, basically a big cybernetic network of sensors, monitoring everything that was going on, directing traffic, doing all sorts of things. You know, this is Ubicomp, baby. I mean, look at those chairs. That's where we want to go. So as I say, Archigram thought of behavior as the raw material they were building with, and systems and services as the things that would enable behavior rather than buildings, and personal technologies being the thing that would really enable this instead of buildings. And I hope you can see a theme building here. If not, I should get off stage right now. They even, and this completely blew me away when I was researching this talk, they used the term social software back in 1972, I think a good kind of 30 years before Mr. Coates and Mr. Shirky and all of those people. And essentially, they were user-centered designers. They were working with technology to create humane and exciting environments with a liberal dash of 60s psychedelia, all the same. But you can read it in their writing. You can read in the poetry that they create around what they're doing. They really love people, and they really want to liberate people with the technology rather than subjugate them. But they did see that software was going to change our environment in incredibly profound ways. They saw that the ghost was in the machine, and the machine was the city. But before you write them off as kind of drug-addled, techno-optimist loons like me, they didn't see technology and systems as a panacea. I really like this quote, just a bump, but I don't know if you can read it at the back, so I'll read it out. "We shall really get somewhere when it has all cooled off a little, and hard and soft become relative to each other rather than opposition." And I sort of wonder whether we're there yet. My friend Chris thinks so, and this is the blink tag, very sorry. He made this. I used to work with Chris at Nokia, and he's an amazing guy, and he's an amazing source of critical thinking about this area of kind of technology place in the city. And he recently, increasing synchronicity around this kind of thing, wrote a blog post about how he thinks, at least, the technology that we're carrying around with us has finally caught up with Archigram's thinking. But as right as they may have been in broad strokes, predicting the future is notoriously difficult. And it's even more difficult if you're on extremely good drugs. For instance, looking at Archigram's schemes, it's plain to see that they think that the car is the ultimate technology of personal freedom. They build cities that have bits driven into them. They kind of have cities with wheels on the side of them. They have caravans that assemble into cities and those kinds of things. And there are giant six-lane motorways going through all of their kind of inflatable, wonderful Disneylands. But the ultimate technology of personal freedom now doesn't fit in your garage. It fits in your pocket. And it's gone even further, and I'll just, you know, make sure that's in there. The car changed the development of the city irreversibly in the 20th century. And my claim, which was kind of built on, is that mobile phones, mobile devices, will do the same in the 21st. And it's from that point of view that I'd like to take you through some urban features that people are constructing right now, with some links back to Archigram and their contemporaries. So we go back to the Garden City, back to the book from Tom Zatik. And it seems to me that hackers being idealistic, motivated, kind of semi-libertarian, semi-capitalist, semi-hippie creatures are trying their best to kind of build this from the bottom up. And this is another book I've been reading recently called On Guerrilla Gardening. Has anybody seen this book? Okay, great. It's about reclaiming space in the city by gardening it without the permission of the people who own the land. And it seems to me that hackers are kind of reclaiming information from the city and gardening it without permission right now. And if you were in, this is kind of a bit of an aside about gardening, but if you're in Matt Biddulph's talk, you might have seen him talk about botanicals. This is the botanicals kit that I made this. I made this. Oh God. Keep reading the script. This is the botanicals kit I made over Christmas, and it was the first soldering I'd done in 20 years. I was really chuffed that I did it. And it connects a pot plant in our house to the internet, and when its moisture detectors down the bottom detect it needs something, it twitters it. Oh, come on. No, I don't mean, come on. I was talking about space colonies, and you're applauding this? Jeez. You'll notice that our plant is called Robert Plant. Anyway. But there are a bunch of geeks wiring up much bigger things than pot plants, thankfully. And before I talk about bridges that Twitter, I just need to go briefly back to the 1960s, wibble, 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 wibble. And back to this conception of archigrams, that behavior is the material that we're working with. And I'm going to introduce you to somebody else from the glorious 60s. This is Guy Debord, French philosopher, head troublemaker of the Situationist International, who, apart from doing all of that good 1960s Parisian stuff of getting the girls and drinking the wine and smoking the Galois and getting bashed in the head by riot police, also coined the term psychogeography, which I love the sign of. And he defined it as the precise laws and specific effects of the geographical environment, consciously organized or not, on the emotions and behavior of individuals. So again, behavior coming through. And doing that kind of hackneyed building a talk thing of going and looking at the definition on Wikipedia, I found an alternate definition cited there, which kind of fitted a bit more with where I think things are going. And it's this wonderful quote, a whole toy box of playful inventive strategies for exploring cities, just about anything that takes pedestrians off their predictable paths and jolts them into a new awareness of the urban landscape. And you can almost kind of directly transpose that onto the things that we're carrying around in our pockets. Our use and experience of the city is being profoundly changed by these things, I think. And they're kind of psychogeographic magic pills or magic wands that give you superpowers and change the city. So back to Tower Bridge. My friend Tom Armitage did some guerrilla info gardening and scraped the data feed of when Tower Bridge opens and closes and created a Twitter account that spits out precisely that. So if you follow Tower Bridge, you get a nice little list of when it's opening and closing for various things going through it. You'll also notice, if you can read at the top there, Tom's doing a bit of city-scale ventriloquism with the bridge. You know, the scaffolding came down on the first part of me to be repainted, and boy is it bright and shiny. Very pleased with my new look. We've come so far. And I've kind of noticed that most of my, increasingly, my friends on Twitter aren't people, and you can see that it's not wrong. You can see that Tower Bridge's friends are quite sweetly statues and NASA probes and radio telescopes. And you know, the best conversations I have on Twitter are with these people. So I was walking around on a sunny Saturday morning in December last year, and I was about 10 minutes away from Tower Bridge at the Design Museum, having a nice cup of coffee, reading The Guardian like a pinko. And I got a little message that I'm going to be opening. So I ran the 10 minutes and while twittering, yay, Tower Bridge opening, ding, ding, infant. And just had a wonderful time. I, you know, that tiny bit, literally a bit of information, kind of turned my morning into something wonderful. And it's this kind of info gardening that people are doing around the city and kind of unearthing things and scraping them and putting them back there, which is really wonderful. And it's part of this kind of broader pattern, I guess, of making the invisible visible. This is a project in Helsinki where I used to live for about 2 years and where half of Doppler are based, called Nuage Vert. And it's a laser beam that sort of draws a kind of cartoon cloud around the exhaust from a power station. And the size of that cloud is based on the energy consumption in Helsinki. So you have this kind of live visualization of the energy usage in a city being presented to you in the world, in the city. And this is not Jack from Lost. This is a friend of mine called Dan Hill. And he wrote a epic, long, huge blog post called The Streetless Platform last year on his site, City of Sound. He lives in Sydney and works for Arup, who are coincidentally the engineers who make a lot of Richard Rogers' buildings work. And he wrote that the way the street feels may soon be defined by what cannot be seen by the naked eye. And I think it's this tension that is really interesting to me right now, is making the invisible visible while other things are perhaps being buried. And we'll come back to that. There's another one of the gurus. Adam Greenfield, who wrote an excellent book called Everywhere about designing in times where everything and everywhere has software embedded in it. He's about to release a book called The City is Here for You to Use. And from that comes this quote. The bottom line is a city that responds to the behavior of its users in something close to real time and in turn begins to shape that behavior. So again, we're not so far away from what Archigram were examining in the 1960s. Behavior and information are as much the raw material to design cities with as steel, glass, and concrete. A couple of examples. There are lots of people working in this area of making the invisible visible. This is a project that I came across recently, which I really love. I think it's called the Watermark Project. And what they do is they go around the city projecting the predicted sea level change on the side of city blocks in the city to bring home kind of the possible effects of climate change. This is a project by Usman Haque, very interesting gentleman, who has just recently started a service called Patch Bay, which I think Tom is going to talk about more. But this is an airborne network of sensors called the Sky Ear, which turn ambient sound into light, and they kind of float disembodied across the city and reflect the activity below them. Kind of playful, beautiful surveillance. You can for sure see the influence of Archigram here. And lastly, in this kind of group, this is quite an old, terrible saying it's an old project, but you know, it's 5 years old, oh my God. This is Biomapping by Christian Nold. And what he did is he rigged people up with a GPS and also with a galvanic skin response sensor, sort of thing that you use in lie detectors. And using this kind of stress sensor and the GPS, he made kind of stress maps of the city. I love this one. It's got this little dot down, big spike in the bottom there, which says Yacht Club Sneaky Drink. Somebody very afraid of being worn out there. But, you know, this is everyday psychogeography. This is the study of precise laws and specific effects in a geographical environment. And this stuff, this is being made mainstream and put into the world as consumer products. And Tom's going to talk a lot more about that, I know. And with these new sensors, we're making new maps. This is the work of openstreetmap.org. And this is a visualization. They gave, I think, about 20 people GPSs for about 6 weeks. And pretty soon, they had this amazing map constructed. Who recognizes where that is? London, right? But it looks like the viscera of a living thing. It's a wonderful, beautiful image. And you can't help but look at that and see kind of biological, cybernetical images come through. This is a picture of neurons in a cow, I think. But, you know, this stuff starts to underline what Lord Rogers was saying. And we've heard from Adrian yesterday about every block and there are similar projects in the UK like fixmystreet.com and streetwire.org. And again, kind of visualizations are kind of starting to make this stuff more grokkable instead of big long lists of kind of civic information. This is a very beautiful piece recently done on a rainy weekend by Sean Allen of Stamen, showing San Francisco as a kind of overlapping mesh of trees, crimes, and cabs. So he's taken sort of these three filters and put them through, and sort of you can immediately kind of see, you can read something about the city in this kind of very beautiful figure. So our future city centers might be extended to be more like that of rhinos, I think. Rhinos have a sense organ for smell, which is basically takes over their entire huge horny head. It's wrapped all the way around it. They have an amazing sense of smell. And they can use this to communicate, and their conversations take place as a result over miles, tens of miles, hundreds of miles, and over months. And again, coming back to Adam Greenfield, he's kind of flipped around Brian Eno's conception of the long now to talk about the big now and the long here, which is a kind of the long here being the kind of build-up of media in place that we're starting to see as we geotag our pictures, as we leave conversations with geotags on them, as we hook up to things like Fire Eagle and Twitter. And so we're leaving our media kind of spore, our kind of rhino poop around the city, and we're able to pick it up months, days, weeks later and sort of get a conception of what our social patterns, our social milieu around the city is in a way we never could before. This is a project from a student at the RCA on a project I was running there, a student called Hiromi Aozaki, and she was directly inspired by Archigram's Walking Cities and looking at flocking and swarming behaviors to create a kind of geolocated search engine which uses swarming algorithms. You can sort of see it's stopped moving, but the little dots moving around are kind of people pinging their location to the internet. And the sliders that you can see on the right-hand side are the things that you want to find or be interested in, or the things that you don't want to be around. And everybody gets to adjust their slider of the city they want to experience. And then the swarming algorithm, a bit like the walking city, kind of picks up your social group and moves it to where your ideal place would be. Kind of creepy, kind of excellent, kind of inspiring, kind of magical, a bit like Archigram. And on another scale in the city, there's another pattern emerging, which is really interesting to me. People hacking together software tools to deal with a very specific place, kind of more guerrilla info gardening again. This is something by a friend of mine called Paul Hammond, Mini Mooney. It's a tool he wrote to put on his iPhone, which is basically just working out where the next bus is coming. And it only works within 6 minutes radius of his house. And he sort of says it on the site. He says, I give no, you know, if you live exactly 6 minutes away from here, you may find this useful too. So in terms of kind of the scale of his market, it's a market of one. It's a market of a certain place. It's got the genius loci of place built into it, and it won't work. It's locked to that context. And Mr. Shirky wrote an excellent essay about this quite a few years ago now called Situated Software, pattern called Situation Software, tools that are very locked into their context. And this is one of my favorite quotes from another architect from Finland in the beginning of the 20th century, Eliel Saarinen. And it sort of gives me a bit of food for thought about this. And he says, always design a thing by considering it in the next larger context. A chair in a room in a house in an environment in a city plan. And if we think about our software like that, and we think about kind of small pieces of situated software loosely joined, you've got a kind of bottom-up open source city full of software, which is as rich as the context it was written in. And, you know, we're really getting there now. So, final stretch, you'd be glad to hear, and I want to get a little weirder, if you can believe it or not. I'm a Welshman, and this is another Welshman, Arthur Machen. And he was very interested in this common human belief that he found in every part of the world, that there are invisible forces at play behind the ordinary world. By which, of course, I mean RFID. It's the mark of the devil, I'm sure. Bruce will preach about that later. It's not really, of course. It's useful, wonderful stuff. This is a project by some friends of mine, again, Timo Arnold, Einar Snev, and Jack Schultz and Matt Webb, where they created a pen that sensed RFID fields. And the pen made a mark when it detected the field. So again, it's making the invisible visible. And I'm just going to let this run for a little while, and it'll become apparent what it's doing. These are drawings that the pen made. And by building this up, Timo and the team were able to sort of visualize these invisible fields around RFID tags. And you get this kind of wonderful butterfly emerging around it of the field strength, sort of figure of eight. Gorgeous. And what this is kind of doing as we sort of pepper the earth in these things is we're kind of making a kind of robot readable planet. Unless we kind of make these invisible things visible, they're going to be kind of opaque to us. They're not going to be readable by us. We're not going to be literate in them. And that's where a lot of the fear and anxiety about RFID comes from. It comes from these very deep places that Arthur Machen was talking about. This is another project by a student I was working with at the RCA, James Chambers. It's a sensor a bit like the botanicals one, but instead of sending its Twitters about what it needs to me, it sends it to everybody else I know. So it makes you cave in to social pressure. You don't actually see any of those messages. And if you carry on to mistreat your things, they will actually post themselves to Craigslist or FreeCycle and demand to be picked up and rescued from your cruelty. I'll tell him you clapped. And it's this thought that there are conversations happening without me, that the bridges and the plants and the cars and everything else are going to be talking behind my back. That kind of gives me the willies, and it also delights me, like most magic. And we kind of, this kind of demon-haunted world, which was the title of my talk, which hopefully you're starting to see why I picked it, is something that we've believed in for most of our time on Earth. And it's really interesting to me that we're starting to build it. Yeah, all right. That was the serious bit, Bruce. Love. Okay, right. All right, good, good. I'm blessed by the Spine Pope. This is an XP shield. Matt Bill talked a little bit about this in his talk. XP is, this is going to be like the year of XP. I mean, you could, if you sort of drop XP into conversations in nerdy coffee shops, people will just go, this is, I'm giving you some buzzword heads up here. It's really going to be the kind of year or two of XP, I think. XP is this, it's an open version of a protocol called Zigbee, which is basically creates invisible wires between things, which is kind of one of the things that kind of schizophrenics talk about a lot, but that doesn't matter. I'm not having a nervous breakdown on stage, honestly. And they connect things together in a mesh at very low power, so they can kind of just wake up every so often and look around, and look around to see if there's something else to talk to, basically. And then if there is something else to talk to, they blurt their little bit of information about whether they need watering or whether, you know, I've been cruel to them or whatever it is. And they look for the next thing up the chain, as it were. And then that thing looks for somebody else to talk to, and it makes this mesh. It makes this kind of cascading conversation of information all around and embedded in our environments, which is a bit like how demons behave in software, right? It's kind of, you have a little process running that just goes, I know this thing, and it shouts it up the tree to the next demon, which shouts it up the tree to the next demon until something happens in the world. And I'm not having a nervous breakdown. And Neil Stephenson, in his essay on technological literacy, which is a fantastic essay called In the Beginning Was the Command Line, sort of describes us, basically, in this world as Eloi, as kind of passive, unaware, illiterate consumers of technology, and the control, those in control of the Morlocks, and they're very invested in keeping us that way. And, you know, it kind of begs the question right now at this kind of point, will we become literate in this demon-haunted world, or will we be the kind of unaware Eloi, not knowing that these things are going on around us and at the mercy of the Morlocks and their bad dental hygiene? So, you know, will these demons be extensions of ourselves? Will they be superpowers, as I kind of optimistically describe them, or will they be extensions of the forces of control? Will they be open and transparent, or will they be kind of dark, magical things that we barely understand? Well, I'm optimistic, like Archigram. I think the kind of bottom-up, loosely joined, situated software that I was describing and that's being built will prove faster, nimbler, and more useful than anything top-down or monolithic. A fine example in this vein is Natalie Yeremyanko's feral robotic dogs. They're cheap robot toy dogs, cost about $30, that are hacked and fitted with sensors to detect pollution and environmental hazards in the city. Natalie goes into communities, and she takes people through the process of doing these hacks, makes them comfortable with it, turning cheap toys into powerful visualizers of pollutants in their environment, again, kind of making the invisible visible. And that makes me really happy, because they're robot dogs, obviously. But it also makes me very optimistic that, you know, as we build our future, it's really up to us if we make it open, transparent, fantastic, and sustainable, like Archigram and Richard Rogers and Natalie Yeremyanko imagined it to be. So it's up to you as well to go out and play with the city, and also play with the stuff of which magic is formed, software. And go and make something wonderful happen. And thanks very much, Webstock.